Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is life like for the people of Burma, also called Myanmar, and what hope do its ethnic minorities have of claiming their fair share of power and wealth under the military dictatorship that rules now? My guest today went to Thailand in 2006 as a volunteer to teach English and computer skills to Burmese refugees who had fled the violence across the border. The experience helped her understand the extraordinary suffering brought on by the Burmese junta in a country that last year ranked 13th on the Fund for Peace's Failed States Index. Mac McClelland is human rights correspondent for Mother Jones magazine. Her new book is called For Us, Surrender is Out of the Question, a story from Burma's never-ending war. Mac, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
How did Burma first hit your radar screen as a place that deserved your attention?
Totally by accident, actually. I was going on vacation to Thailand, and I was deep into a Google search, and I found some information about this huge refugee crisis that was going on in Thailand. And we sort of have these vague ideas about Burma as a bad place or a place you wouldn't really want to live, but I'd never heard anything about hundreds of thousands of refugees from there. And for the next couple of years, I kind of kept an eye on the situation, but still never found any satisfactory explanations about why this massive refugee crisis was happening and who these refugees were who were in Thailand. And so eventually I just went to check it out.
Yeah, and so you went and volunteered for a group that you've given a sort of pseudonym to in the book for the protection of everyone involved. And your job was going to be to teach English skills and computer skills.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And when you got there, how different was it from what you had expected?
Well, I didn't actually know anything about the people that I would be working with. For security reasons, the organization's website doesn't actually really say anything about what they do. So I didn't know what their mission was outside of it vaguely being pro-democracy in Burma. And I didn't know who worked there. And so I didn't realize until I arrived that everyone who I worked with was a refugee who had run away from refugee camps, which in Thailand is illegal for them to live outside of the camps. And they snuck back and forth over the border, which is also illegal, so that they could document these atrocities that the junta is inflicting on villagers.
Let's step back for a minute and get some background information here. Burma gained its independence from Great Britain in 1948. How has it been ruled since then?
Well, it's been under a dictatorship since 1962, so it's the world's longest-standing military dictatorship. There was independence in 1948, but within months of independence, the country was at civil war, and it has been at civil war ever since.
What sort of ethnic groups exist in Burma?
There are a lot of different ethnic groups. The group that I was living with were Karen, and they had what was for a long time the biggest and the most threatening insurgency against the regime, but there are also other ethnic insurgencies in that country. There's a group called the WA, which is now 20,000 soldiers strong, and they run a lot of the drug dealing of heroin and methamphetamines in the Golden Triangle, and they're probably the world's largest drug army. And then there are Shan groups, which also have some factions of insurgencies. There are, you know, it's a very diverse place, and they have never managed to find sort of a common ground politically between these groups, which are fighting for autonomy, and the government, which, you know, doesn't want to give anybody anything.
I was really surprised to read that Burma is the world's second greatest source of opium.
Yeah, it actually was the largest for a long time until Afghanistan took that distinction over, and that only happened because we went in there and ousted the Taliban, and, you know, then their opium production went way up. But for a long time, it was Burma, and now they're closing back in on Afghanistan because they've actually been ramping up their own production in recent years.
Why is there such violent tension between these ethnic groups, and in some cases, among these groups?
Right. There's wars on all fronts there.
Yeah.
Well, this particular group, the Karen, that the book is about, they're the ones who have had the longest insurgency in Burma. So they went to war with the government in 1949. So it's been more than 60 years, just a year after independence, they officially declared war. So, you know, this is a lot of the times this is the answer, but a lot of it has to do with the British. They took over Burma in a series of wars, and they favored the Karen, who had long been, you know, sort of culturally divided from the majority groups. And so they were using the Karen as police, as military soldiers and commanders, and they trusted the Karen, and that deepened an already existing ethnic divide between the Burmese and the Karen, because they were getting all this favoritism from the British. And then they fought for us. They fought for the Allies in World War II, and they were promised autonomy and independence as their reward. And then, of course, when World War II was over, the British and the Americans just sort of bailed on them. But that rift that we had helped foster in these particular groups has never been mended.
So, Mac, what kind of day-to-day restrictions does the ruling Burmese government place on everyday citizens living there now?
Pretty much everything that you could possibly think of doing here in the United States would be illegal for you to do as a Burmese person. For example, if you wanted to make a flyer and pass it out to your friends or on the streets, you would have to first go through the censorship board. So you can't disseminate any kind of information, basically, period, unless you have government permission to do so. Also, you can't talk about the government in any way that is even mildly unflattering. So if you turn to somebody on the street and you said, you know, I have something negative to say about one of these generals, that person could turn you in, and then you could go to prison. So unless you have glowing things to say about your rulers, you can't say anything at all. And you can't talk to the press about it. A lot of Burmese people have been imprisoned for talking to Western journalists who come in there and ask them questions, and then they get caught. One person was given 25 years in prison for giving a short interview to a BBC journalist several years ago, and that is not uncommon.
And you can't have more than 5 people gathered in one place.
That's correct, because that could always lead to some sort of protesting. And as we learned in 2007, that is not something that the junta deals with well.
So how are the battles fought today between the Karen insurgents and the government?
It's guerrilla style. The Karen have, though they used to be a huge insurrection, you know, this has been going on for such a long time, and a lot of the weapons that they had started with were, frankly, ones that the Allies had given them and trained them with, and they've lost a lot of territory, you know, over time, and those weapons are getting older. They're losing some of their numbers as the Burmese government gets a bigger army and defeats more of them. So it's waged mostly in the eastern hills, right along the border with Thailand, which is what sends all those refugees over into Thailand seeking protection. The government will come in, and they will just start burning villages down and shooting at people in order to capture any Karen territory and make sure that it's under their control. And then everybody just has to run away.
And then once these people are refugees and they go into Thailand, they are protected from the violence, but they get very little else. They can't leave, they can't work, they can't travel. They're sort of stuck there.
Yeah, that's right. Well, Thailand was not excited to take on another 150,000 refugees. You know, Thailand already had Vietnamese refugees and Laotian refugees. And so they don't actually even recognize them officially as refugees because they don't want to have to take responsibility for taking care of them. So other governments and a lot of NGOs are actually responsible for the care of these refugees because Thailand does not want to be involved and does not offer them basic sanctuary protection. Many of the guys who I lived with used to live in refugee camps where armies would come over from Burma and burn them down and kill people, and that has happened dozens of times. So even though they're on Thai soil, they are unfortunately still not guaranteed protection from attack.
So we know that Burma is exceptionally poor. Refugees have no access to resources. Other than the drug business, what is funding the rebels?
Well, they used to have a lot of territory. The Karen in particular used to have a lot of that territory on the border with Thailand, and a lot of goods flow through there. And there's a lot of smuggling. It's really big in Burma. You know, you have all those government controls, and so you have a big black market. So when the Karen controlled that territory, anybody who wanted to bring, I mean, it could be anything, T-shirts, you know, anything that goes through Southeast Asian markets, if you wanted to go over that border, you had to go through the rebels and you had to pay them taxes. So that's a big part of the reason why the government wanted to take that territory back from them so that they wouldn't have that source of income, which is why, you know, their income is actually going down a lot now, except for the ones that are drug armies.
So you were living when you were in Thailand with a group of very young people who had left Burma, all of them under terrible circumstances. They did, however, live outside refugee compounds, even though some of them had family members who were there. Why did they take that risk knowing that they could be deported right back to Burma for breaking the rules?
Well, I think the way they described it best, when I actually went to a refugee camp with one of the guys at some point, and we were hanging around there, and he was commenting on how nice it is to not have to worry about the police arresting him at any moment because he was inside the refugee camp, which is where he's supposed to be. And so I asked him, you know, why don't you move back here? And he said, I can't work for my people here. You can't do anything in a refugee camp except sit and wait. And he was born in a refugee camp, and his child was born in a refugee camp. And because he wanted to feel like he was contributing to the cause and working for his people, he had to do that outside of there, you know, illegally as part of this organization.
And other people who choose to leave there, a lot of women and children end up as sex slaves, as prostitutes.
Yeah, well, there's, you know, that is a big problem in that area. There's a lot of trafficking. You know, a lot of them don't do it voluntarily. Ones who do get sort of trapped in a cycle where they just can't get out of it because they don't have any protections from the Thais, because the Thais don't recognize them as the people who they should be protecting. They treat them as illegal immigrants, so they can't go to the police. And it's true. It's incredibly unfortunate that this refugee situation is further exacerbating an even bigger and more horrifying problem in the sex trade.
So how did it work for you as a white woman to move into this house full of sort of renegade refugees? What did it take for them to trust you?
Cheap Thai beer helps, frankly. They're not a suspicious people. They believed me when I said that I was there to volunteer and I was sympathetic. I mean, it's hard to believe anybody could not be sympathetic, frankly. So for me to tell them, you know, hey, I'm on your team, I think it's easy for them to believe that, because to them it would seem ridiculous that anybody would not be. And, we just spent a lot of time together because we lived together, so we ate together. You know, we had our meals together, and we hung around the house together, and, just, you know, we just hung out as friends. And, like I said, we drank a lot together. And those were the circumstances under which I asked them a lot of questions and learned about all of their really fascinating, though, you know, totally horrifying stories.
Yeah, and it struck you that they weren't even aware of some of the things that we don't even consider luxuries. They didn't believe you at first that there was such a thing as a hot shower outside of a movie.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because it was just something that was completely foreign to them. Because there's no electricity in refugee camps, and there's no electricity in the villages where they came from, those of them who had lived in villages. And, you know, of course, most of the developing world doesn't take hot showers, but in Thailand it is far from unheard of. And they even had one of those little on-demand hot water heaters in their shower, and when I pointed it out to them, they were like, oh yeah, we've seen that. They didn't even know what it was. And when I was suggesting to them that they should, maybe we could heat up some water and they could try it, they were not interested at all.
Mac McClelland is my guest. She's human rights correspondent for Mother Jones magazine. Her new book is called For Us, Surrender is Out of the Question, a story from Burma's never-ending war. We'll resume our talk in just a moment, and you can join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of personal and professional development courses start this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
Yeah. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is human rights correspondent for Mother Jones magazine, Mac McClelland. Her new book is called For Us, Surrender is Out of the Question, a story from Burma's never-ending war. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. So, Mac, your housemates were refugees, but they traveled frequently across the border into Burma in order to document these atrocities committed by the Burmese army. First of all, how were they able to get back and forth?
You can actually just walk back and forth in a lot of places. Those countries are only separated by a river that at certain times of the year is low enough and narrow enough that you can actually just wade across it or swim across it or take a boat across it. The border is so long, you know, it's like our border. You can't have people at all points of it. People can slip through. So you walk through the jungle and then you're on the other side.
Mm-hmm. And they could have been in serious trouble had they been caught, but it didn't happen very often that they were caught.
Yeah, fortunately, it was not super common with the organization that I worked with that the guys were apprehended by Thai soldiers or Burmese soldiers. Actually, they were in danger from both sides. So if they got caught by the Thais, they could be deported or they could be handed over to the Burmese authorities, which would be really bad for them, or they could just be jailed or bribed or blackmailed. And sometimes they are actually killed, refugees who get picked up by Thai cops. So there's the danger on that side, and then in Burma, of course, you know, anything goes when it comes to rebels who run into Burmese authorities.
So talk for a minute about what they collected on these sort of information-gathering sorties.
Well, they take video, they take audio tape, they take pictures, and they do interviews. So if they're walking, while they're walking around, they will come upon dead, discarded, tortured bodies, not infrequently, just while they're going from village to village. And so they'll take pictures of those. There are pictures of piles of dead children, lots of decapitated people who were forced to work for the Burmese government. And then when, you know, they had outlived their usefulness, they're just killed and discarded in the middle of the jungle. They will interview torture survivors and take pictures of their scars and ask them exactly what sorts of torture they underwent at the hands of the soldiers. They take pictures of, sometimes they're there when the villages actually get attacked, and so they have video of the government coming in and burning these villages down and people running and screaming for their lives. So it's a wide range of really compelling, honestly, footage that then they send to news organizations in the West and try to get them to play it.
Why don't we see that footage more often?
Yeah, that was what I was asking when I got there. They were like, yes, we have sent this to CNN. And I was like, well, you know, are they using it? I think part of the problem is that this conflict is so old that it doesn't seem to news organizations like news. You know, these rebels have been fighting the government for 61 years. So even though it's been a lot more violent and a lot more bloody lately, that ramp up in the violence and in the war, for some reason, maybe just because it's part of such a long-standing, entrenched thing, just it doesn't strike news organizations as newsworthy. I mean, I'm sort of speculating because to me, it certainly seems like the footage is very juicy. You know, I mean, it's horrifying, but it's the sort of thing that you would think that you would want to use if somebody gave it to you.
What association did the guys that you were living with have with the Karen National Union?
Well, some of them had been soldiers in the Karen National Union. Some of them were kids of soldiers or brothers of soldiers. Everybody had some relationship or another with the Karen National Union, besides the fact that this organization, and that's another reason why I wasn't allowed to name it, works with the Karen National Union because their soldiers will escort these guys sometimes. And, you know, Hank, because my guys didn't carry guns, you know, but the Karen National Union soldiers will. So a lot of times they will travel together, or KNU soldiers will help them find their way, you know, to villages, and they also help them try to avoid attacks while they are walking around in villages, getting these stories down, which, as I mentioned, unfortunately doesn't always work, but, you know, at least they're trying to use this guerrilla intelligence to keep them safe while they're trying to document what's going on.
Now, of course, the U.S. Department of State has classified the Korean National Union as a terrorist group, which gets in the way of any of these people wanting to potentially resettle in the United States or in a lot of other Western countries.
Well, it had. They actually declassified them as terrorists, I think it was 2 years ago. So when I was there, yes, these guys, due to a clause in the Patriot Act that criminalizes what's called material support, which basically means hanging around ever with anyone who's part of a terrorist organization or helping them in any way, which all these guys, of course, did. If they hadn't been soldiers, they knew soldiers and they assisted soldiers and worked with soldiers. So because the Karen National Union was a terrorist group at that time, these guys were terrorists by association, even though they were fighting a government, you know, that the United States is far from being a fan of. And so thankfully, Condoleezza Rice eventually rectified that, and they have been taken off the terrorist list so that now there are actually tens of thousands of Karen refugees in the United States that have just moved in the last couple of years.
Mac McClelland is my guest. Her new book is called For Us, Surrender is Out of the Question, a story from Burma's never-ending war. Our number is 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Diane in Dallas. Hi, Diane.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
I wonder if Ms. McClelland is familiar with the book Burma Surgeon by Dr. Seagrave, who is a fourth-generation, Dr. Gordon S. Seagrave, S-E-A-G-R-A-V-E, a fourth-generation medical missionary in Burma, the child, grandchild, and great-grandchild of missionaries in Burma, who had a hospital pictured in his book at Nanking, I think. There are pictures of him in his book with General Stilwell. He had to evacuate towards India from Burma when Stilwell marched out of China. In his book, he describes all the different tribes of Burma, and they all worked for him as nurses in his hospital, and they all got along. And particularly the Karen, they got along with everybody, and he taught them to be nurses, go back to their communities, help their communities out. He is a Johns Hopkins graduate. I wonder if his influence is what made the Karens become Christians.
I'm familiar with that book and the sequel, Burma Surgeon Returns. And actually, I'm on a book tour, you know, for this right now. And on Monday, one of his granddaughters showed up at one of my events, and I met her, which was amazing. And he did do really great work in Burma, but he's not the beginning of the Christian influence there. The first American missionaries to go overseas actually ended up in Burma, you know, and this is in the 19th century, and it was Baptists from Massachusetts who actually started it. So that that sort of legacy of the missionaries going there was well before his time, but it still is alive and well now. A lot of the groups who are helping take care of the Karen refugees are Christians, and they fundraise to feed them and to provide them education in American churches.
How much education is it possible to get when you're living in a refugee camp?
You can go through high school, and you can go. They have a couple of beyond high school programs that last a year or two. There's an Australian university that offers sort of a satellite class where you can get a certificate in computer or something like that. But you know, you don't have anywhere to go after that, and none of these programs, you know, these high schools and these refugee camps, which are run by NGOs, are not accredited. So even if you did get out of a refugee camp and you came, say, to the United States, you kind of have to start over. You know, you have to take your GED and that sort of thing. So a lot of the guys that I lived with, the reason they went to refugee camps in the first place was so that they could get an education, because their villages, because they're always under attack and they have no money and no supplies, could not provide that for them. So the fact that the infrastructure in Burma is such a disaster and education is so hard to get is actually another factor of driving this refugee population up, because they go to Thailand just so they can learn to read.
Talk for a minute about their access to technology. There's sort of a funny story in the book in which you introduce your housemates to the concept of MySpace.
Right. Well, the guys in refugee camps, you know, there's no electricity and it's not like everybody has computers or anything like that. But these guys, because they collect all this information and they're supposed to be sending it to Western organizations and the United Nations and other governments and things like that, they have taken some, you know, basic computer skills classes, and they have volunteers like me who come and show them, and I, you know, was not supposed to be showing them MySpace, but that's a skill. So they work with computers every day in their work, but by and large, these refugee populations do not have access to that kind of technology at all.
And it strikes me as actually a really potentially powerful tool for explaining to the rest of the world what's going on.
Just computer access in general?
Computer access and even things like social media.
Sure, right? I mean, when we had the elections in Iran, we were kept sort of abreast of the situation via Twitter and Facebook pages. And in the 2007 Saffron Revolution, when, you know, the monks protested and the government cracked down and started shooting at people, as they always do when people protest in Burma, the fact that there were some bloggers and videographers who were smuggling footage out of Burma is one of the reasons why a lot of people think that only a few dozen people died in this particular protest, because they were getting that information out to the rest of the world, and the junta knew that people were watching them. So they do definitely try to crack down on information technology access as much as possible, because they know that then it sort of puts people's focus on them, when for the most part the rest of the world is ignoring what they're doing, which is why they can get away with doing whatever they want.
Now, Mac, you really liked the people that you were living and working with, and you empathized with them, but multiple times during your stay there, you came up against really sort of antiquated ideas that they had about gays and lesbians. Can you talk about that a little bit?
They claimed, and you know, as my friends, I have to believe them because I trust them, that they had never met a queer person in their lives, and that they had only even ever heard of the existence of non-heterosexuals 1 year ago because some Canadian volunteer told them about it or something. So when I got there, being queer, it caused a little bit of a stir when we were on MySpace, and I was telling them this is my ex-girlfriend and, you know, these are some of my other friends. And they were saying that it doesn't exist in their culture, and that if they did meet a gay person in Karen culture, they would exile them from a village. And I think that was just sort of their knee-jerk reaction and not something that they had really ever thought about, because, yeah, we got in a lot of fights about it, some of them drunken, some of them very heated, where I would say to them, you guys are refugees, you've been exiled from your homes, and it's the worst thing, and you're spending all your time fighting to get your rights back. But what you're saying is you would do the exact same thing to other people. And most of them actually came around. It was just not something that they had really ever been confronted with. There's no, you know, there's no concept of gay rights in Karen culture, because it's not something that that they encounter.
Interestingly, though, they were okay with you because you were a Westerner and they understood that you had sort of different sets of rules for how you would live your life.
Right. They were like, oh, that's fine for you, you know, because you're a white person and white people can do whatever crazy stuff they want. But in our culture, that does not belong, which was, you know, when I started making this argument about how, you know, oppression is oppression. It doesn't matter what culture we're talking about or what the nature of the difference between the parties is. The fact that they wanted to oppress people in turn for a difference in the way that they have been suffering their whole lives, just, I mean, it doesn't make any sense. And like I said, you know, they came around and they said, you know, we appreciate your ideas. It's not something we had ever thought of before. Not all of them, sadly. I can't take credit for converting all of them to being gay rights crusaders, but for the most part, they did end up eventually empathizing.
Do you think you would have had a harder time as a gay man?
Yes, mm-hmm. I do. I think another part of the reason why they were like, sure, okay, yeah, we'll take your point of view, was because it's less threatening to heterosexual males, you know, most of the time, to not be dealing with homosexual males, but, you know, queer women instead. But, you know, but maybe I'm not giving them enough credit.
How much contact are you able to have with them after this experience? It was 4 years ago that you went.
Right. I went back again in 2008, and I was there for a month and spent some time with a bunch of them. Although now they've been pretty scattered because the Karen National Union was delisted as a terrorist organization. The United Nations launched the biggest resettlement program in the world for Karen refugees. And so last year, the 50,000th Karen refugee left for another country through Thailand. So a lot of them are in Australia, they're in Norway, they're in England, they're in the United States. Some of them had to go back to refugee camps because they needed to be closer to their families or because it was getting too dangerous for them living outside of the camps. Maybe they'd been arrested one too many times. So I actually keep in touch with most of them via email, and we talk on the phone. I have their cell phone numbers, and we try to keep track of each other and check in every once in a while and see, you know, who's having babies and who lives where and how everybody's doing.
And one of them, and I hope I'll say the name right, Tanda, actually now lives in Northern California, not far from where you live, and is having a really hard time adjusting to life in the U.S.
He is, and a lot of them are, especially these guys in particular. I mean, it's hard for any refugee, of course, to move to the most kind of foreign culture that they could imagine and try to deal with having jobs and paying rent and figuring out how to survive. I mean, we have, you know, natural-born Americans in this country who struggle every day with being part of the underclass, of course, and so when you put on top of that this culture and language divide, it is incredibly difficult for a lot of these guys to adjust. But on top of it, these guys are activists, and they want to work for their people. And so the fact that they're so far away and so caught up in trying to survive economically in American life means that they can't work for their people, and that is driving them crazy.
Mac McClelland is my guest. She's human rights correspondent for Mother Jones magazine. Her new book is called For Us, Surrender is Out of the Question, a story from Burma's never-ending war. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of personal and professional development courses start this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Mac McClelland. She's human rights correspondent for Mother Jones magazine with a new book out called For Us, Surrender is Out of the Question, a story from Burma's never-ending war. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. You state here, Mac, unequivocally that you believe that what's taking place in Burma is genocide. At the risk of sounding simplistic, tell us why.
Well, there are rules about what constitutes a genocide and what doesn't, as set forth by the United Nations. And if you go through the checklist, which is, you know, are they trying to get rid of this population? Are they preventing them from propagating their culture? If you go sort of down the list of things that qualify a situation as a genocide, this fits absolutely. The horrors and the atrocities that are going on are akin to things that we've seen in, you know, prior genocides, but it just hasn't been called that yet. And part of the reason why we're not talking about it and we're not hearing about it is because it's the lack of such a politically charged, but in this case, absolutely accurate term.
Why do you think activists within the UN and other places have not moved to label this a genocide?
Well, it's hard to, I mean, we still, in a lot of governments and in a lot of UN organizations, are not recognizing the Armenian genocide as a genocide when it most certainly was, and everybody knows that it was, and that was 100 years ago. So it's basically for political reasons. It's you know, bureaucratic red tape. We don't want to make China mad. Would China be angry if we started? Because, you know, they're really strong economic allies. China is definitely on Burma's team. Would we upset them if we lobbed this very justified charge in Burma's general direction?
If that were to happen, what sorts of powers would international law have to do something about the problem?
Well, in theory, you know, after Rwanda and after Bosnia, the United Nations said, okay, that was a failure on our part. We admit it. We didn't do anything. Never again.
That's we keep saying never again.
Yeah, oh yeah, we say that all the time, right? Never again. For this time, we mean it, though. Never again. So as part of that, in 2005, the United Nations World Summit, the Security Council committed to take action if there was genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes. And so, in theory, if there was a resolution passed where the Security Council could agree, yes, it's true, we have all this proof, there's video, there are pictures, there are survivors, I mean, there's no lack of evidence, we're going to have to go ahead and admit that this is a genocide, then they have to figure out what to do next. They can try sort of engaging with the state first, but, and, you know, in the case of Burma, that is probably not going to work if they come over there and they tell them they need to knock it off. Burma doesn't have to listen to anybody if they don't want to, and they probably won't. So in failing that, you can actually override state sovereignty, and you can put peacekeepers on the ground, which is what we need to protect these incredibly vulnerable populations in the Eastern Hills.
So do you feel like Burma has effectively been grandfathered out of this new resolution because the conflict has been going on for so long?
I don't think it's because the conflict's been going on for so long. I think it's because people don't know about it, and so there's no call for action. I mean, the way that Darfur got so much attention was because the people knew, you know, citizens knew. And so citizens started demanding action and conversation from politicians about it. The Obama administration is well aware of what is going on in eastern Burma. They have Burma on a genocide watch list. Not that being watched is particularly useful to people who are on the business end of a genocide. The United Nations knows what's going on. But because citizens don't know, because it's not in the news, nobody's making them talk about it. And once they talk about it, they'll have to do something. And so for the time being, they're just sort of avoiding it, and they're totally getting away with it.
What sort of potential pitfalls are there to economic sanctions in a place like Burma that is already very poor, where it would, as has happened in other places, what happens is that the rich continue to stay rich and the poor get even poorer?
Sure, of course. I mean, sanctions didn't work for us in Cuba, and they didn't work for us in Iraq. And we have these sanctions against Burma where we pulled out, let's say, you know, we had money invested in garment factories. And even the State Department has admitted that when we pulled those investments out, a lot of those workers ended up being pushed into the sex industry because they don't have anywhere else to go. But even our own sanctions don't enforce American companies who already have money in Burma's oil and gas to get out. So Chevron still operates in Burma and still earns the junta $1 billion a year on this huge gas project that they have there. So even our sanctions are totally hypocritical and have holes in them.
So your current job is as human rights correspondent for Mother Jones. Can you talk about what that work entails?
Sure. It's a new position at the magazine, and this is, you know, we're sort of on a Burma focus at the moment because there is an excerpt from the book in the current issue that's on newsstands now. But basically, we're going to do more of this reporting from places where people never go and people never talk about, even though there are really fascinating and compelling and crucial stories there. So it's not totally decided where I'm going to go next, but you can anticipate more long-form and embedded reporting from locations that people just don't hear enough about.
Yeah, I guess there really is no way to effectively cover human rights issues without being in the places where people are at risk.
Well, you certainly can't cover it in a way that people can engage with so actively. Part of the reason why people are having an easier time sort of understanding the situation in Burma with this book, or so they're telling me, is that the characters seem like actual people, I've had several interviewers say, you know, these people actually sound like people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course they are people. And so it makes sense that they would. But if I hadn't been there and hadn't spent so much time with them, very personal time, then they wouldn't come across that way. And that makes it harder for people to sort of engage with this situation that seems sort of, you know, far away and unrelated to their daily lives.
Yeah, it was an interesting choice, I think, for you to present them in all their dimensions, including, you know, the weird things they like to eat and what they do when they're happy and stressed out and how they respond to certain things, because they're not simply just sort of nameless victims. They're people who have entire lives, even separate from the suffering they've experienced.
Right. And I mean, and of course they are, right? I mean, all victims of everything are real, you know, fully dimensional people. But that just is, unfortunately, a side of them that we never get. And that makes it really hard, I think, for us to connect with those people. When you read reports, you know, about victims from advocacy groups and things like that, you can't really get a sense of who these people are. And I think that makes it harder to empathize and really internalize a lot of what is going on.
So clearly, most of the places where you will be doing this work are highly resistant to the presence of international journalists. How do you plan to get around those restrictions in order to do your work?
Very carefully. hopefully it won't be, you know, so you can go into Burma illegally easily enough as you know, if you just walk over a border, basically. But if you get caught, you know, you can be in really big trouble. Hopefully a lot of the places where I'll be going won't be as tricky as working with that incredibly prickly junta is. I mean, most places don't have, even if they're resistant to coverage, they don't have the sort of controls in place that Burma does, which is a very extreme example. So we're going to try and do it on the up and up, but if it doesn't work that way, then so be it. We'll figure out another way.
Talk for a minute about what happened when you went into Burma legally. For one thing, you were told on the Thai side, you don't want to go there, lady.
Yeah, right. The Thai guard, he asked me where I was going. Obviously, I was going to Burma because it was, you know, I'm standing at this checkpoint. He was like, you don't want to go there. That place is terrible. But I had to go, actually, because I had to renew my visa. And also, you know, I'd been spending weeks with these guys telling me all this horrible stuff about what's going on there. So it was kind of like going to a car wreck. I had no idea what it was going to look like. But I just went into a major city, which is outside of, you know, this war zone, basically. From where I was standing in Burma, there were crazy fighting and, you know, refugees running around and trying to escape only a few miles from where I was. But in the city, you can't really get a sense of that. You can't really see that that's happening. But you can get a sense of the sort of controls that the government tries to keep on its people. For example, somebody saw that I was dropped off at that checkpoint by one of the refugees, and they're clearly of this different ethnic group, which is Karen. And so I had a shadow the entire time that I was there, and he just badgered me and followed me around for hours and refused to let me be by myself. And he kept asking me, you work with Karen refugees? I think you work with the Karen. Do you know the Karen? And asking me where they lived and what they did. And, you know, I just denied that I had any idea what he was talking about. But you can see how it's so demoralizing, you know, to have that sort of interrogation constantly. I was only there for a couple hours, and even I was incredibly dispirited and exhausted, so you can't even imagine what it must be like for people who actually have to live there all the time.
Do the Karen sort of look physically different from their neighbors who are ethnically Burmese?
Yes, they do. They do certainly to each other, Karen people and Burmese people, that, you know, they're different tribes. They have different histories. They come from different places in Southeast Asia. They just happen to, you know, come together in Burma, in this case, unfortunately. But, yeah, they can definitely tell the difference. And besides that, they just have different languages and different customs. They also have different features. Even I, after only being there for 6 weeks, could, you know, sort of distinguish some of the differences between them.
Is there any move by anyone to try and sort of peacefully all coexist together? Or does everyone really just want their group to be in charge and let the others go as they may?
Oh, no. Most of these ethnic insurgencies aren't fighting, for the most part. For the most part, that's my disclaimer, are not fighting each other. They are all fighting the government. And it's not like non-ethnic insurgents, just regular, you know, civilians in Burma, they also hate their government. Everybody who lives in Burma hates that government because it is a terrible, terrible machine. So these ethnic insurgencies basically all have the same enemy, and they don't want the Karen. Their end goal is not to be in charge of Burma. They don't want to be the kings of Burma. They just want to be autonomous within Burma, which is true also of the Shan and of the Wa and of the Mon and all these other ethnic groups that are there. So they could all get along, absolutely, if the junta would let these people determine for themselves how to live and how to run the areas of the country that they live in instead of just attacking them and terrorizing them all the time.
How do you protect your sources to ensure that they don't suffer repercussions for giving you information?
Well, these particular guys, as you mentioned, you know, some of them live in the United States, and so they were not in danger anymore. Nobody is going to come all the way from Burma to attack Tata in Sacramento. So those ones, luckily, you know, I don't have to worry about them anymore. But the ones who are still there, they are definitely still in danger, and so I had to change their names. And there were a couple people who I just kind of left out of it entirely because their situation was too dicey to talk about or get into.
Was there ever a point where you felt sort of personally spooked about what you were doing? You weren't there as a journalist at the time.
Correct.
So did you ever worry that you might be sort of getting into territory that could lead to danger?
I mean, if I had been arrested for consorting with these refugees who were doing very illegal stuff in Thailand, I wouldn't have been the first Westerner to have done so. So it is possible. The biggest danger that I was in was basically being arrested or deported or blackmailed by Thai police, which, you know, would have been a drag, but frankly is not, it's not super high risk. The other time that I was there, I did cross into Burma illegally, and I could have also been arrested there, and that would have been a trickier situation. But, you know, when you're there, you don't even think about that kind of stuff. The kind of danger that, you know, my friends were in and their very real problems, nothing that was going to happen to me would be, the threat of any of that wouldn't be enough to stop me from getting into, you know, covering this story and these stories of these people that deserved it. You know, my motivation was strong enough that I honestly didn't even really think about it.
Mac McClelland is human rights correspondent for Mother Jones magazine. Her new book is called For Us, Surrender is Out of the Question, a story from Burma's never-ending war. Mac, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thanks for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.